Tuesday edition. Today's date is May 29th. I'm reading the month number here. May 29th, 2007. Darryl Bradford Smith, great to be with you today. Of course, lots of things have been happening in the world. One of them I want to bring up right away here is Ms. Sheehan has finally gotten fed up with the nonsense, and I'm sure that she's completely engulfed in Zionists around her, as you would be if you didn't know that that stuff was going on. Probably get the Phil Bergs and the Gabriel days of the world swarming around this woman, so she can stay marginalized in her efforts. And of course, she probably got so sick of doing what she was doing that she just finally threw in the towel. Sad that is, you know, but she didn't have a clue in the first place. Nobody brought her up to speed about just how deep the rabbit hole goes, ladies and gentlemen. You know, anybody in this listening audience and anybody out there who has an interest in the facts and the truth, if you look any deeper than just the surface, you're going to find out that this is a Zionist Jewish conspiracy with their helpers. And they're taking the world down as they did in World War II and I and before them. This is a sickness that has swelled around the human family for generations. And they are beginning to work very diligently at marginalizing the three of us. As much as that saddens me, it's not surprising, because as the facts about 9/11 come out as being an Israeli operation with their henchmen in the American government, what you're going to find is that these people are going to turn up the heat against us, as they have against one of our colleagues in this fight, Christopher Bolin. And I've asked him to come back on today, talk about several subjects, but the first I'd like to discuss with him is his pending court case, which is this week. And as you all know, we've put numbers and email addresses up on IamTheWitness.com so that you can help Christopher put a little bit of pressure. Let people know over at that courthouse, let the judge know, let the mayor know, let the police chief know that this is being watched by a great number of people. And I want to bring Chris up right now. Chris, are you with me?
Yeah, hello, Darryl. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Chris. It's nice to have you back. I told you right before the court that we would do something, and I think it's very important that people understand that it's the 31st. You're going to be walking into a courtroom on trumped-up charges, and everybody who's listened to this show knows what they are. What's an update on what's going on with this mess?
Yeah, well, today I was in court. I brought in a pro se motion, about 100 pages long, because my first motion that my lawyer submitted, based on the destruction of the evidence, asking for sanctions or dismissal of the charges based on the police destruction of the videotape. You have to understand that when the police assaulted me, it was a very brutal assault. They threw me down in the yard. They broke my right elbow. They tasered me while I was in handcuffs, and one officer, about a 200-pound guy, was kneeling on my temple, on the side of my head. Whenever I talk about this, I get a little uncomfortable feeling. But this, my wife tried to photograph it, but the police, and she was denied, she was threatened if she did that. She had the camera in her hand. But the police did videotape it, but then these videotapes have all been erased, recycled. And this is destruction of evidence. So today I was in with this pro se motion, which I've had, worked on for a few weeks, and I presented it. My lawyer couldn't be there, although my lawyer is going to argue this case, this for me, in a few days. But my motion was, not denied. It was accepted. But the judge said that, Judge Reedman, Hyman Reedman, said that, I have an attorney, and my attorney will have to, present this now or argue this. Now I didn't press it because, the Illinois Bill of Rights, Section 8 says that, a defendant has the right to represent himself and, by counsel and not or. So, but I didn't ask Judge Reedman what is his, understanding of Section 8 of the Illinois Bill of Rights. I thought that, that would be unnecessary because he was ruling. He ruled that and this is kind of controversial, the idea that you can represent yourself and have an attorney and by attorney at the same time. But it's in the
Well, you can be considered co-counsel, I believe.
Yes. But the three main points of my motion were that when the Hoffman Estates, when this undercover team came to my house, and it was an undercover team, they say so in their press release, that when the undercover police came to my house as plainclothes men wearing blue jeans and the dark blue, bulletproof vests, what have you, and t-shirts, they didn't identify themselves. And then they arrested me and they seized me. And this is important because these kinds of hit squads or undercover squads are becoming increasingly popular in the United States. And they didn't provide adequate notice that they were police. They didn't identify themselves as police, although I asked. And this is implicating my Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable seizure. That, you know, guys can come to your house, dressed up, you know, in these kinds of clothes, civilian clothes. I mean, it just happened to talk today. A similar type thing. People dressed as police came into a building and kidnapped about a dozen people, Germans and British. And, you know, they looked like they were police, but they weren't police. You know, the police have to be identifiable, and they have to identify themselves to the people that they're interacting with. That's essential. The second thing is that the destruction of evidence that I talked about, this, whether it was willful and wanton or whether it was, you know, in normal course of business, their destruction of this videotape evidence that would have, exonerated me is a violation of my Sixth Amendment right to have, a compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in my favor. And then the third thing was the fact that I have discovered, I was dismayed to find that there is a prejudice at the state attorney's office in Cook County that some of the state's attorneys have said that, for example, that they were going to have two Jewish attorneys prosecute me because they don't like my writings. They don't like my...
Now, you have any evidence that you can bring forward that can show these things?
Well, we have affidavits of the people who heard these things. Well, in one case, it was told to my attorney by the state's attorney, and my attorney told me this in a phone call just before the April 23rd trial date.
Mm.
And when I heard this, I was utterly dismayed.
Yeah,
I mean, I was flipped. You know? And I talked to my attorney the other day, and he said, you know, he thought it was a joke. But he didn't tell it to me like a joke, and I certainly don't think it's a joke. I don't think it's a joke. You know, you know how we are under the gun.
Yep.
You know, people who are writing about the war, that this war in Iraq, critical of the war in Iraq and Afghanistan and what Israel is doing. And when we're critical of when we find, you know, I have found some Israeli, indications that Israel had prior knowledge or was involved in 9/11. That's a very vulnerable position because very few people are willing to talk about this.
Yep.
You know, Carlo Cameron was shut up. Paulo Lima was shut up. These people, you know, Paulo Lima wrote for the Bergen Record. He was the first, you know, in New Jersey, he was the first guy to report that these five dancing Israelis were, in fact, Israeli.
Yep.
He talked about it for one or two days. That was it. And I thought that was very odd. And then the fourth thing is in my motion to compel and to get this case dismissed is that when the police attacked me, or these men that were in undercover who turned out to be undercover police, they threw me down on the ground, they fractured my right elbow, that happened when I fell or when they knelt on my elbow. But then one of the men, jumped on my head and put his knee against my temple, my right temple on the side of my head, which is a pressure point. And it's a pressure point which is very critical for the body. And he knelt on that pressure point with his 200 pounds for at least 2 minutes. And this is, we were claiming that this is torture and that this was a murder attempt because, you know, in the first aid guides you read, it says to put pressure on this point should only be done for a very brief period, like if there's bleeding on the scalp, because it can cut off blood to the brain and cause damage if held over 30 seconds. And they left this on, this guy was kneeling on my head for about 2 minutes, and my wife saw it, and she saw my face was turning purple, my eyes were bulging out, and this is when she wanted to go to the house to get the camera to photograph what was happening to me, and when she came out of the house, this one officer blocked her like a football player and tried to put his arms up so she wouldn't take any pictures, because they didn't want any documentation of their attack. And so those are the 4 points, and I had this 100-page motion in there with all these little tabs to argue it if I was allowed to. But as I said, the judge said no, and he said that we'll hold on to it, we'll keep it, but it'll be for your attorney to argue. And my attorney had filed a motion on the same day, much smaller motion, only pertaining to one of these things, that's the destruction of evidence. And on Thursday morning at 9 o'clock in room 107 in the court, before the trial begins, he will be able to argue these motions. And that's good, I think, because that means that the people, the witnesses, the subpoenaed people will have a chance to hear some of these arguments before the trial begins.
Yeah. Well, you've got to understand that, and I'm sure you do, because it is happening to you. But you, myself, and Eric are we're being marginalized. They're using violence to silence you, but the rest of us, what we're finding out, Chris, and you've seen it too. They don't want us telling any more of the story. They really don't. And it looks like they're willing to go to any length, including breaking the law, to have us stop. And that's a frightening place to be sitting in for myself and you. I'm sure Eric, we've talked about it several times. What do you think, their biggest fear is about us three, other than the fact that we're not getting the traction we deserve. You know that. But the fact is, if you take a look back at our research, the things that we've put out, the things that we've discussed, the person I had on recently, Ray Fink, talked about so many powerful things. You can't, what do you think's really going on here? Are we targets?
Yes, of course. This is what in this motion, I have a large section about the ADL. Because the Anti-Defamation League began smearing me already back in November of 2001, and they claimed that it was because of they said that my writing, I wrote an article about eyewitness evidence of explosives in the World Trade Center, and they said that I wrote for this that our newspaper, that at that time it was American Free Press, I was indulging in anti-Semitic or conspiratorial views, and I was writing that the mainstream media was ignoring this evidence of explosion in the World Trade Center. Well, that's very true. They were, and they have been all along.
Yep.
But you see, what they want to do is they want to try to discredit or defame. The Anti-Defamation League, their basic tool is defamation.
And that's
right. They want to defame people like you and me and Eric Hochschmidt and Professor Jones. Professor Jones has written a letter on my behalf, you see, and he was taken down. He was demoted. He was taken away out of his classroom. He was removed from his classroom like Socrates or Galileo. And they said, no, you cannot teach the young. And he's now, semi-retired, but he's still allowed to do research. So they want to discredit people who are, engaging in real, honest research in 911.
Yeah,
because the lies have to prevail in the minds of the people who perpetrated or who are behind the 9/11 terror and who are behind the war in Iraq and Iran or Afghanistan. They have to maintain this fiction.
Yeah.
And in order to do so, they have to discredit and defame those who are doing real research. And unfortunately, there's very few of us.
Yeah.
And we're vulnerable.
Well, some of the things that they've used against all of us, and there's still a whole stream of lies and nonsense coming out from the American Free Press people, and we've discussed the fact that there's some very strange goings on over there. Mr. Petrick being into the occultism, and of course Mr. Piper now. What I see him doing is mirroring a tactic that was used by Scott Mufkafka there some time ago. When Eric and I were putting out stories and doing interviews about a year and a half ago, every interview we did and every story we did, he would mirror it within a day or two. He would try to get the same guest, but if not the same guest, he would get the similar story, but he would put his own little spin on it. Now, this same thing has started cropping up with a new writer, Mark Glenn, over there at American Free Press. with a recent story on the USS Liberty. So what I see here is that this professional disinformation tactic of stealing the person you'd like to marginalize's work and make it your own is on in full force at American Free Press. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, that's called stealing the thunder, you know, taking somebody else's story, taking somebody else's research and claiming it as your own and then, you know, trying to steal from that person the credit and taking it as your own. That's a classic disinformation technique. And as you say, they want to be the ones who are owning and in control of this information. That's what we're up against. That's all there is to it. But you find very few people. I found all along in the first 4 or 5 years of the 9/11 research, I found very few people who were, for example, doing the asking the research, doing the research I was doing, or calling the people I was doing. And I often spoke about this. It was like a smorgasbord of stories out there of research to be done, but nobody was taking it. Nobody was doing it. And then I realized that there's a reason for that.
Yep.
We saw what happened to the Carl Cameron pieces that he wrote, that he did for Fox TV back in December of 2001.
Yeah.
And, you know, these were squelched. These were politically, taboo.
Right. Well, I mean, and you also can notice too that with this recent Mark Glenn piece, when he started talking about the USS Liberty, he wanted to shove the blame as much as he could, if you read the piece, as much as he possibly could onto President Johnson. And
yeah,
there was no indication in any of the interviews I did with Lieutenant Commander Innes, who was on the deck that day, and his research over the last 35 years,
right,
that indicated President Johnson had any hand in it until very late in the game. And that came many, many, many hours after the USS America was underway en route to saving the Liberty. And so if Johnson would have had a hand in that, he would have been involved in having the USS America dead in the water long before they were sent there. And there's no indication of what Mark Glenn is writing about as being accurate in his piece. And it's just one more example of twisting the truth just a little bit, and then it's amazing. But they must be worried about these facts leaking out.
Yes, of course. The assault on the Liberty, you know, which is basically, what is it, 40 years ago next week or so.
That's right.
And this is it'll probably be discussed because 40 years, after the attack of the assault on the Liberty, the book by the Skipper Innes is very, very good. But
yep,
as you said, those were Israeli Mirage fighters that attacked the ship. And
that's right,
the ship, and scraped the ship, and torpedoed the ship.
Yeah, and they had torpedo boats.
Yeah.
But Christopher, you know, they removed the insignia off their aircraft, which had the Star of David. They removed that. They removed the identification markings on their gunboats. So they were planning to murder or destroy this ship. That was the intent from the beginning. Otherwise, they would have never had all of this clandestine subterfuge going on.
Yeah, it was meant to be a false flag attack. They were planning to blame it, if the ship sank, you know, they were planning to blame it on the Egyptians because the ship was right off the coast of Egypt and Israel, off the Gaza Strip there. And of course, if President Johnson had in any way, you know, I know President Johnson ordered the fighter jets that were on their way to support USS Liberty during the attack, they were ordered back. And you know, as the book says, they were ordered back because they were carrying nuclear weapons. And the insertion of nuclear tipped fighters into the conflagration of the Six-Day War, you know, was seen as maybe being, but no, but they were called back. Johnson called them back, and of course I've always wanted to ask McNamara why he did that when I saw him skiing out there in Aspen. But the point is that if Johnson had really had anything to do with against the Liberty, he would have, if he wanted the Liberty to be scuttled or taken away, he would have just ordered the ship removed from the scene. He's the commander in chief. He would have said, you know, go back to Spain or something.
That's right. And not only that, he did not order the admiral of the fleet, who was actually his flagship was right beside the USS America, and at the time the USS America was the second largest aircraft carrier in the fleet, and it was a brand new carrier. And how do I know? I served on that ship. And the simple fact of the matter is they sent the America back, they did not tell it to not go and aid it, but the admiral actually continued to steam forward to go and help these people. In other words, he made believe that the order from Johnson didn't come through. This was not an order that Johnson had made in advance. Otherwise, they would have had an ironclad chain of command going on where the America was never engaged in this.
Right. Well, you know, this, like what you said, what the tendency is here is that they want to shift the blame from the actual perpetrators of the attack, in this case were Israeli planes and boats and ships and military, and try and put that blame onto the U.S. president, you know, not a very popular president, Johnson. And in the same way, you know, many people in the 911 community want to put the blame for 911 onto President Bush or Vice President Cheney. You know, I agree that Bush and Cheney have a lot to answer for 9/11 and the war in Iraq. I mean, their failure to have an investigation, et cetera, et cetera. And Cheney apparently had prior knowledge. I mean, I agree that these men carry a great deal of culpability. And because they are our elected leaders, they are the first ones who should explain what happened. And they haven't done that. But that's not to say that evidence that points to other countries or other players should be ignored. Because these men are our president and vice president.
That's right. You're exactly right. Here we go again. You know, with our research, we've looked into people. Christopher, you and I have been on. You've been to my house, Chris. Let's talk about credibility here. Am I a rich guy, Chris?
No, not at all. No. You at Thanksgiving a few years ago. I drove into the middle of France, far out there. And I know you live in this little village out there in the middle of France.
Well, I mean, but the interesting thing is, I don't know if you remember my car at the time, but it was a little Italian Punto that looked like it was ready for the trash heap. It's since died. In fact, it died not long after you left here. You know, I barely get by, but of course, people write that I'm all about the money. There's other people who say that my wife is black. Is my wife black, Chris?
No, she's not black. But
why am I bringing this kind of nonsense up? Well, these are the kinds of things that they will resort to, and because our message is not assailable, so instead they are going to assail and attack the messenger. And that is the point I'm trying to make here. The fact that our message is beyond reproach, but so they're going to come after you, myself, and Eric on the grounds that we are, I live in France, so I have no right to have an opinion about what goes on in America, or my wife is an African, so that the people at the Stormfront and the Vanguard will hate me, or in other words, there is a concerted effort to go after every community who would possibly be interested in our research and destroy our credibility. And they're doing it with you, they're doing it with Eric, and they're doing it with me. And, you know, I have to tell you, I'm a little bit proud of it, because obviously it must be worrying them. But at the same time, we need to find a way to get our listeners to start wrapping themselves around our truth and starting to promote it better in the press.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can tell you that this attack on me was very devastating. The brutality of the attack was devastating enough. I mean, that was terrible. But as this process goes on, and in this country, in the United States, when you're charged, as I was, with two misdemeanors, I was charged with resisting arrest and aggravated assault against a peace officer. You're basically guilty until proven innocent. It's backwards from what we expect, that you're innocent until proven guilty. You are guilty until proven innocent, and all of the options or all of the avenues that I could get out of this heretofore involved my accepting guilt for one or other charge.
That's right.
You know, and that the Hoffman States offered a deal a little while ago that I should release the police. I should sign a release releasing the police from any wrongdoing, and that then they would only charge me with having wagged my finger in the face of one of their officers. You know, this, and I didn't do that. And my contention has been all along that I'm innocent of these charges, And as I investigated, I found that there was a conspiracy to injure me.
That's right.
There were half a dozen police cars on their way to my house before anyone got here. That the fire department was on its way. They had been forewarned there was a fight in progress 3 minutes before anybody even arrived at my house. And that this was really a very well orchestrated attack on me.
Well, do you know, you and I, can I tell you something? And you may not remember this, but just a month prior to this attack on you, you and I were on this radio show discussing Chertoff.
Yeah.
And we discussed him, and then I think about 6 weeks before that, 2 weeks earlier, we had done another show on Chertoff and on Marcus Wolf, and we had discussed the impending tyranny. And we put out some very strong worded statements about Chertoff's complicity. Not only that, but his complicity in the first attack on the World Trade Center in 93. And those things, I think, did not go unnoticed.
No, of course not. Of course not. But, you know, we're not the only ones. I mean, this is in the news. The people know that he was a U.S. attorney in Elizabeth, New Jersey, at the first 9/11 attack. And that
yeah.
he was therefore responsible for the evidence and the prosecution and what have you. And people know, if they care to know, that he was also, you know, in the senior official responsible for the federal response to Hurricane Katrina. I mean, but the mainstream media avoids this. Michael Chertoff is very seldom discussed in the mainstream media.
What is his background again exactly? Give our listeners a little upgrade on this guy. Does he have? Is he a rabbi, or is his family of rabbis?
He comes from a line of rabbis, famous rabbis in New York. His father, his father's name was Baruch, was a rabbi. His grandfather was a rabbi in the Jewish Theological Center at Seminary in New York. It's a famous Jewish institute. And it's the teachers of the Jewish religion and the Talmud. And his grandfather was considered one of the most best scholars of the Talmud. But his immediate father, I think his name was Rabbi Baruch, Chertoff, married, an Israeli woman, and her name was Miss Eisen, Levia Eisen. And she was originally from Czechoslovakia, but she was, living in Palestine, you know, pre-Israel Palestine, and she was working. She obviously was working with Israeli under intelligence, but call it whatever you call it, if it was Mossad at the time. But in 48 and 49, and she was involved in something called Operation Magic Carpet, whereby the Israelis were flying thousands of Yemenite Jews out of Yemen. Up the Red Sea to Israel on, you know, flights.
Yep.
And this went on for a long time, and she was involved in this. I mean, that's public knowledge. That is something that I found in, a biography or an obituary when she passed away in Florida or what it was. What I found interesting is that when Mr. Chertoff became the Homeland Security czar, this was not discussed. The fact that he's a dual national, I think is what you'd call it, Israeli-American, because when your mother's Israeli, that makes you an Israeli national. Whether you take the passport and do the military service at the higher level of citizenship, that's up to you. This is something that would be discussed. When the man who was first nominated for this position, the former, the guy who was supposed to be the first Homeland Security czar, and he had a checkered background. His mother had some,
Bernard Carrick?
Yeah, Bernard Carrick. When Bernard Carrick was, you know, the first nomination, he was attacked for his mother's, shady past and things like that, and all kinds of terrible things were brought up, and then they said, well, he wouldn't be appropriate. And then Mr. Chertoff was a shoe-in. But no discussion of his past was done. And this is the kind of thing, you know, that I would find, you know, I'd say, well, this, you know, what about his Israeli background? I mean, is this good? Is it bad? Is it relevant? I mean, because Mr. Chertoff is, you know, as a Homeland Security czar, he's responsible for the Coast Guard. He oversees, obviously Homeland Security. He oversees the borders. He oversees the Palace Guard, I call it, the Secret Service.
And he's been one of the people that they have kept above criticism. He's a guy that they don't allow out in front because I think he's going to be one of the puppet masters long after Bush fades away.
Yes, yeah, that could be. But you know, this is the thing, is that this kind of influence that he has, the power that he has, is immense. And you know, when I come into the country and you're checking in at the immigration naturalization checkpoint there, and you see the picture of George Bush and Michael Sheratov on the wall, you know, like in the old Soviet Union, you see the pictures, these are the guys. So, and it's a little bit discombobulating, a little bit scary to think that, you know, you're not allowed, as a journalist, you're not allowed to discuss these people. You're not allowed to write about them. You're not allowed to point out, you know, some important, relevant facts about these people for fear of retribution,
mm-hmm.
for fear of what happened to me.
Yeah.
You know, I have never written, I have to say this, I've never written an anti-Semitic thing in my life because I'm not an anti-Semite. I never have been. You know, I write about Israel because I have some knowledge about it, I have some experience with it, and my degree is in Middle Eastern studies. I specialized in it. So, you know, I can bring some knowledge and some discussion of it to the newspaper, to wherever I write. But, you know, to see that I've been targeted or that this is, people are discrediting me or defaming me because of this unfairly. It has been said, the ADL's attacks on me are most unfair. And what I didn't understand, what I always encouraged American Free Press to do when ADL would criticize the paper as being anti-Semitic, I said, you know, a right-wing anti-Semitic conspiracy-minded paper, I'd say you should sue them because,
yeah.
you know, if we know we're not anti-Semitic, we haven't written an anti-Semitic word, we hadn't at that time, then sue because there was a couple in Denver that sued the ADL for such a, you know, slander, libel, and won $10 million. And furthermore, when you're a young newspaper, a brand new newspaper like American Free Press was in 2001 in the fall, you need to defend your reputation. You cannot allow people to libel you and slander you.
Well, that's presuming that they weren't all, I mean, you know, it's always been my contention. Now, I don't have cold evidence on this, but it seems to me that that was that the organization may well have been a setup organization but from SPL there, Southern Poverty Law Center. And it seems like there's a controlled opposition. And one of the things that they like to do, Christopher, you know as well as I do, is any facts that come out, they want people they can easily label anti-Semitic as bringing out those facts so that nobody pays attention to them. They go, those are those Hitlerite nuts. And of course, it's an easy way to discard any evidence that you do bring out into the open. But the newspaper really never did very much digging unless it was your articles coming out for the most part.
Yeah, there's some truth there, you know, and what you say about this co-play between the ADL and the people that they maybe control or that they, the journalists or the speakers that they control, this is very, like you said, you described it very, very clearly. This is what they do. So they get people who have a bad reputation, who they have slandered, they have smeared, and then these people are bringing out the stuff so they're discredited from the get-go.
Well, that's exactly what they tried to do that day when they allowed what's his name from Louisiana there, David Duke, onto CNN live, and making these claims with Wolf Blitzer, and then all of a sudden, you know, they had several days worth of he's just an ex grand wizard of the KKK, and he hates Jews, and that's the only reason he's saying these things. And what they were trying to do is exactly what I just described, and that's the only reason they brought David Duke on television.
Yeah,
because look at the way they handled the interview with our information. Look at the way they handled that, Christopher. It was a completely different approach. See, they didn't give us any direct airtime. Although with my conversations with their producer, I said, "Put me on the air live, or I'm not going on." I said, and they said, "Oh well, I'll talk to Paul Azan about it." Well, yeah, there was no live time for me, and the fact is, they wouldn't let you do it either. And of course, they approached us as a hit piece where they gave David Duke free run so that because they knew what they were going to do immediately after he left the airwaves was tell everybody he's a big anti-Semite, you shouldn't trust him. And you know, if it's not clear to people who saw that, then I don't know what to tell you.
Yes, and CNN did the same thing to me. You know, they interviewed me. They came out from New York to Schaumburg, Illinois, interviewed me at the library for 2 hours. You know, they spent a lot of time on this, and then they took 30 seconds, and they focused on this one, when they asked me, oh, but, you know, people will read your stories, will, you know, they'll think that you're an anti-Semite. Are you an anti-Semite? And I said, of course I'm not an anti-Semite. And then they cut from that, and they went right to somebody from the ADL, and that ADL woman, you know, speaking in New York or Chicago, she said, well, that's what they all say.
That's right.
So the viewer gets the impression, well, you know, he says he's not an anti-Semite, but that's what they all say. And you know, the thing is, I want to say, you know, they did the exact same thing to Professor Stephen Jones, you know, last September.
Yeah.
They had him on radio, National Public Radio Station, the affiliate at the University of Utah,
yeah,
in Salt Lake City. And they let him on. They were not interested. This Doug Fazio was not interested, really, in the science of Professor Jones. He wanted Professor Jones to say something about who he thought was behind the attacks of 9/11. And Professor Jones went out on that thin ice and said, you know, well, you know, people like Webster Tarpley have said it's people from the international banking cartel, something like that. He attributed it to the quote, somebody else. But then after Professor Jones was off the air, they had a couple fellas on there, Jewish guys, one from the University of Utah, one from Northwestern University, and they put words in his mouth. They said, well, when he says international banking cartel, what he's really saying is you know, Jews, Jewish bankers, and that's anti-Semitic. And from that, you know, from that hypothesis, from that extrapolation, they wound up getting this man fired from his job at a Mormon school in Provo, Utah.
But isn't it interesting? He was right on target. The international bankers did order it, and it trickled down to these henchmen that they've got employed, like Wormser and Faith and you know, and Wolfowitz and the rest of these crooks, Ladine, and I mean, we can go down the list, Chertoff and the rest. It's an easy 1-2-3 step right to the action of 9/11, and then everything that emanates from that goes right back to these same crooks. You know, Christopher, I feel so frustrated at times that you know, we're being marginalized because if we're going to save ourselves truly, and this is my great hope that people do wake up in time to stop this. We're certainly going to have to do better in the numbers than we've been doing, and it breaks my heart to think that this effort would flounder and fail because of their success at defaming us. See, I don't want to leave the outcome in their hands. I want to take the reins of this truth and into my own hands and bring it to the people myself. And but we're being thwarted here, and I'm wondering what you think we can do to make this a better, more effective approach.
Well, like I've always told Eric Hoopschmidt, we have to have better websites and better information, and we have to do the best we can to bring out the truth that we know. But you see, this is a war. It's like when I go to court. Every time I go to court, it's a battle.
Yeah.
And it's a battle in which I am facing these accusers, and they are only telling lies. And this is what is most disturbing, is that I just want to say what happened to me and the truth and defend my name, and I have this army of people, the police and people, who are ready to tell the damnedest lies to beat me in court, to convict me. And this is the same thing with 9/11. You have this whole army of people who are ready to lie and tell the damnedest things, like whether that there was blue screen technology or whatever. And then people who are telling the truth, simple truths, like Professor Jones, analysis of the molten metal, or discovery of evidence of thermite.
Have you spoken to Stephen lately?
Oh, well, by email, I thanked him for his letter, I think. I spoke to him about a few weeks ago.
Because, you know, one of the things that I've talked to you about, and Eric has talked about as well, is that we warned him of the danger of who the people he had surrounding him. And I guess, you know, being the type of guy that he is, he's more of a researcher than he is looking into the real workings of disinformation. I don't think he caught on to what we were trying to say until it was too late, when he was a scholar for truth. And then he seemed to jump from the frying pan into another fire with this other organization, because the names of the people around him are frightfully unreliable.
Yes, I know. I know, like Jim Hoffman and these people. The thing is that Professor Jones is very, has been historic, you know, he's naive about this deception and disinformation. And as a professor, he knows something about the politics of science, but he, you know, 911 is such a hot potato.
Yeah.
And he has approached this as a big tent kind of guy.
Yeah.
We'll go under this big tent and everybody's invited and we will talk about our truth and our research and let the chips fall where they will. Let's see who can convince the audience, like a court. But also like a court, there's a lot of exclusion of evidence and things like that going on, so that the truth is not always the one that prevails.
Well, yeah, look at the frustration with Cindy Sheehan, and it's exactly what she said in her short essay, was that the people around her were just swarming and backbiting and nonsensically tearing apart every attempt she made at any effort. Now, granted, I don't think she's up on the subjects as well as some people could be, but the fact is she was being, I think, swarmed not dissimilarly as Professor Jones was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, they'll take people like this, Cindy Sheehan or Professor Jones, and they will use them to, carry the credibility and bring people to their cause. And then they will control that cause. And that's what they did with the 9/11 movement with Professor Jones. That's what they're doing with this anti-war movement. I mean, whatever anti-war movement there is. The 10 Americans died yesterday or, you know, today in Iraq. This has been the worst month of the year so far. It's just outrageous. I can't believe that there isn't more resistance to the war. But, you know, as we saw from the Democrats in Congress, there is no real opposition to the war.
That's right. That's right.
And this is for me one of the most painful things about this, you know, because that this war is accepted by so many, and that they have turned this country into a huge mercenary force that they take here and there to destroy countries and commit, you know, really genocide.
Well, you know, Chris, your family and your children, and geez, you know, our hearts and our thoughts are with you, and I'm going to ask again for you to to give your information so people can maybe help you out here. You can go to IamTheWitness.com, ladies and gentlemen. There's a section for Chris on how to get in touch with the court and send them an email and let them know you're listening and watching. But your website too, because this is going to be updated on your site and ours. So why don't you give your information out?
Yeah, my website's very simple. It's www.bollin, B as in boy, OLLYN.com. And I want to thank the many listeners who have written to me from having listened to your radio. I mean, your shows have opened up the eyes of many people. And my biggest supporters come from having listened to your radio show. And what they tell me, some people have told me that they were scheduled to go to Iraq. And then they listen to your show and they realize, no, I'm not going to do this, because this is the only place where they had heard, what's really going on in Iraq, or what the other side is, what it all means. You're doing a great, great work in bringing the other side, because unfortunately in the United States today, our media is one-sided like a toothbrush.
Yeah.
And Americans are only getting one side of the story, if at all. So that, you know, you talk to people come back from Iraq and they'll tell you that what you're hearing and seeing on TV about Iraq is just the tip of the iceberg. And we know that, you know, because we saw the coverage from Vietnam, you know, 40 years ago. It's nothing like that now. We don't see the pain. We don't see the suffering. We don't see the human cost. We don't even see the caskets when they come home from Iraq.
And we're not even seeing the right casualty numbers either.
No, no. And it's, you know, we're living in a fairy tale or
an Orwellian nightmare.
A nightmare. And it has come down on us so fast, and it is so pervasive that, your listeners see, know what we're up against. But it is really, really insidious.
Well, you know, I've started to coin a phrase calling these criminals that have perpetrated this Judeo-Nazis. And if you know anything about World War II's I.G. Farben and Max Warburg and the rest of it, and how the whole war was micromanaged by Zionist Jews, you'll understand that to say Judeo-Nazi is an accurate statement, not inaccurate, because the history bears out that relationship. And what we do, what we're doing now, is bringing that relationship 60 years forward. The next generation of Zionist criminals are employing themselves at taking over the entire planet. And World War III is on the offing with these guys, because if you take a look at the plans that they laid out some years ago, Christopher, they needed a third war to consolidate their power worldwide. And this is going to plan so far. I mean, I don't think they ever intended to go to Iraq and win. I think they intended to go there and destroy the place and create havoc and mayhem and completely destroy the population so that that place no longer is habitable. It doesn't seem like they ever went there to win anything. They went there to destroy the place.
Yes, yes, and this is what they're doing with the depleted uranium and the so-called sectarian violence. It's just it's horrible. And that the American people have not been given the truth about this is because the media is utterly complicit in this sham.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, the brave new world, you know, meets the United States, is that the media is completely deceiving the American people about what's going on and the threat that Iran poses, what have you, Sudan, you know, this is a huge regional war, and chaos is bursting out all over. It's spreading through the region like a California wildfire.
And it looks like Israel has new designs on a second attack on either Syria or Lebanon or both this summer, and I'm sure they're going to have a false flag, something or other, to get it going, like that fake kidnapping went on. And you know, there's real suffering here. There's real death and destruction going on here, and it's no different than it was when Stalin was taking orders from his handlers, and they happened to be all Zionist Jews, and he killed 60 million, and Hitler took his orders, and he killed untold millions, and we're going to go into a period here in this earth where these criminals are going to order the death and destruction of many, many more of us, and if we don't stand up now, we're all going to become victims, all of us, more than we already are. It's a horrible of a prospect, but it's true.
It's a very horrible prospect. I shudder to think about it, but you know, in the Middle East today, it's happening. You know, the Israelis have tanks and fighter jets attacking Gaza Strip every day.
Yeah.
A defenseless population of squatters, mostly of people who are refugees. And
yeah.
And then the United States is assisting the Lebanese army in their attack on this militia that is in the camp up in Tripoli in Lebanon. You know, it's just, it has to end, and American Jews of conscience have to speak out.
They do.
They have to speak out, because otherwise the most radical militant Zionists will take their name and operate in their name.
Yeah.
And it is very, very detrimental for you know, future relations in the region. I mean, this has to end. But you know, it's hard to follow on what you said, because what you're talking about is so discouraging.
Well, it is, and I got to tell you that the urgency of it is it's now or never. But here's the other thing I'd like to ask people to do for us. I've asked you this before. When you're out surfing the net for information, if you come across somebody trashing Eric, myself, or Christopher, come to our defense. Because what's needed out there is that because there's a huge group of disinformation people trying to their very best to destroy us. If it's not Kurt Maynard, it's Kurt Nimmo. If it's not Nimmo, it's Alex Jones. If it's not him, it's Piper. It's Muff Kafka using pseudonyms on websites. It's opposing digits. It's no-low jobs. It doesn't matter where the mud is being slung from. It's an attempt to stop the truth from coming out or from us helping people gel around an idea of resistance against this. And it's important that you guard our work here so that more people can be invited into this fight with us. And Chris, you know, this battle that you're having in the court, I think would probably have a greater success if that was also done. So this is important that people guard our reputations out there, because ultimately, if we're going to be speaking for so many people and the facts, we need people to go out and defend those facts.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that none of the people, the 9/11 community, this so-called mainstream alternative group, they have not come to my assistance at all. You know, you can see from this attack on me, when they attacked me and charged me, I can see who my friends are from my enemies. And the people that you might have thought might come to your assistance, the 9/11 community, you know, these organizations that even raised legal defense funds for the 9/11 scholars or what have you, have not done anything for me. They don't. They've done absolutely nothing.
My
support comes from the average people of the United States, Canada, Australia, and Europe, who realize that you know, my work is interested in getting to the truth, and I'm not a bigot, and I'm not a smear journalist. I'm simply doing research and writing from evidence about what I consider the crime of the century. I mean, in my lifetime, it was a terrible, terrible thing. I was in New York that day. And it's, you know, if we don't get to the truth, if we don't stand up for the truth, and if we submit to the lies, it's exactly what you said will come true.
Yeah. Wow. I want to thank you again for coming on. It was an important thing. We're going to do an update on your case after the fact. I hope all goes well on the 31st for you, Chris. And give my love to your family and take care of yourself, will you?
Thank you, and I want to thank all the people who have supported me with kind words and donations to my legal defense fund, and many of them are listening today. I want to thank them all from the bottom of my heart.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's Christopher Bolin, investigative reporter and friend of mine. This is the French Connection's little update today on this case, and we brought up a lot of subjects on sidebar issues, but I think they're all important, because if you see the flow of this going in a certain direction, you know where we're heading, guys. Defend us so that we can defend you. And make sure you support us with $1 or $5. Put it in PayPal. You can go to the website. You know, we're right to the bone over here. Every one of us, me, Eric, and Christopher. So please, do your best and fight hard and write a letter to the people that you can find on Chris's website and ours. Until the next time, this is Daryl Bradford Smith telling you to be well. Bye bye now.